From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few months after the writer David Foster Wallace had killed himself in 2008, D.T. Max wrote a piece for The New Yorker magazine about Wallace's last year or so, his struggle with paralyzing anxiety and depression, and his frustrating attempt to finish a book that could live up to what some think of as his masterpiece, the novel Infinite Jest. But Max wasn't satisfied. He wanted to know more about Wallace's early life. He wanted to learn about the things that influenced him. He didn't want to write a conventional biography, though. He says he wanted to tell a story that was alive. He has said, "I wanted to feel like he could walk into the room the minute you put the book down." Today in the program, we're talking with D.T. Max about his book, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When D.T. Max wrote a piece for The New Yorker about the writer David Foster Wallace a few months after he had committed suicide in 2008, he said he felt like the article hadn't finished the job. Max had focused on Wallace's last months, his struggle with depression, his attempt to finish a book that could live up to an infinite jest, the novel he had written that some think of as a kind of postmodern masterpiece. Max has said that he didn't want to create a conventional biography. He wanted to first tell a story, to explore Wallace's early life, his upbringing, his influences. But he also has said he wanted to really get at what he has called Wallace's great cause as a fiction writer, to create realistic fiction for a world that is no longer real. Today in the program, we're talking about the book D.T. Max has finished. It's called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, A Life of David Foster Wallace. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. D.T. Max is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of two books. His newest, as we mentioned, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, A Life of David Foster Wallace. He's joining us today from the offices of The New Yorker magazine in Manhattan. And D.T. Max, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I wanted to begin by asking you, you mentioned in the acknowledgments of the book that that you hadn't actually met, didn't ever meet David Foster Wallace, but you say you came close.
Yeah, that's right. We came extremely close, actually several times. The closest we came in person is that, as I write in the acknowledgement, I was at the publication party for Infinite Jest, the 1996 novel that I think David's reputation really depends on, this extraordinary 1,100-page I consider it absolutely classic, but an indispensable novel. Anyway, David didn't feel any of these things when he was dragged to New York for his publication party. He didn't like New York particularly. He wrote to a friend that he felt like whenever he was in New York, all his nerve endings were on the outside of his skin. And all the same, you know, the gods of publishing must be served, and so they had an enormous party for him at a downtown kind of cocktail lounge. So I'd never met him, although I'd obviously seen pictures of him, but for some reason I had no real idea what he looked like. And I walked into this room, this huge kind of cocktail lounge room, and across the way, in my memory anyway, under this bright kind of strobe light, is poor David Foster Wallace, you know, with these little granny glasses and right. Bandana and this kind of, you know, mountain mic outfit that he wore in the midst of all these New York swells. And I mean, I didn't know what he looked like. He really looked kind of like he'd rather be anywhere but there. Right. That if he could just be beamed somewhere else, that would be perfect. And later in researching the biography, I came upon a letter he wrote to Don DeLillo. Mm-hmm. And in the letter he says, he writes to DeLillo, who had been invited and not attended the publication party. And I think he may have been the only one who didn't attend. He writes to Don DeLillo and he says that he had just been to his first publication party, and if God is in his heaven, it will be my last.
Right.
Now, what's also good about that letter is I don't really think it was his first publication party, which begins to tell you a little bit about the difficulty in trying to write a biography of somebody with as many layers as David. But I also had kind of a very pleasing other encounter with him, which is that I came in looking at the journals that he kept for his last book, which is called The Pale King, the book he didn't finish. I mean, to some extent, which caused the despair, which would lead to his suicide. He wrote in there about an article I had written years ago about the short story writer Raymond Carver.
Yeah.
And he wrote a little sort of little complimentary thing about my article and wrote next to it Dan Max, which is, you know, my actual name. To go through the world is not DT Max, but Dan Max. And so I thought it was really kind of rewarding that he knew who I was, because I had no reason to think that, that he did, and that he liked something I had written. It was very pleasing for me.
Mm. When did you first become really aware of David Foster Wallace? I know that you loved his book, The Broom of the System, when you were younger. Was this your first encounter?
Yeah, I mean, it was his first book. You know, David, had he lived, would be 1 year younger than I am. One of the amazing things about David is that every generation from mine, I'm in my early 50s, down to people, to young people in their 20s and even their teens, think David's their contemporary.
Right.
There's something absolutely astonishing. I was at a publication party the other day, and a college-age woman said to me that, you know, oh yeah, David was a little bit older than me. He was in his 20s. And I was like, well, no, he wasn't. But there's a quality in his writing, and I think most of all, really, in David's way of relating to people that made him feel like a peer. So back in the 80s, he publishes this wonderful, spirited, funny, sparkling, huge novel, a kind of a big joke of a novel called The Broom of the System. Mm. And although his great book, Infinite Jest, you know, has jest in the title, really The Broom of the System was the jest. It's just a playful kind of Pynchonian accumulation of details and set scenes and wonderfully drawn characters and brilliant, sparkly dialogue, all under the banner of a kind of Wittgensteinian look at life. It's hard to imagine a 23-year-old could do it, but he did. And I love that book and just adored that book. And I actually had read it several times over the years. I read it when it came out. In 1987, and I read it after that, and you know, whenever I just felt like reading it again, I'd read it again. It was sort of a touchstone for me, and so I was devastated in writing Every Love Story is a Ghost Story to come upon a letter from David to John Franzen, the novelist, where he says that he feels nothing for the book, that it could have been written by a very clever 14-year-old. And I thought, well, that's a shame. That's, you know, I've sort of staked my claim to David on the wrong book. And then, you know, over the years, one of the pleasures of writing Every Love Story was I went deeper and deeper into David's writing. I should have done it sooner, but, you know, you're always open to a certain writer at a certain time.
Yeah.
It was really only after David's death that I truly opened myself up to Infinite Jest and the extraordinary things that are in that book. And now, you know, I've sort of come out the other side of Infinite Jest. David wrote a very thorny story collection. He wrote this collection published in 1999 called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. There was actually a movie made of it, a very small movie. It came out a couple of years ago. And there's a letter that he wrote to his editor, Michael Peach, where he says of that book that it's a book that's mean to everyone whom it's possible to be mean to. And that's the one I'm really into right now. That's the one I'm digging deep into and seeing amazing things that I hadn't realized were in that book. And that's David. You know, you come to him at different times and open to different things.
I mentioned that the New Yorker article that you wrote a few months after he had killed himself. And you've talked about how there were these parts of that story that kept kind of sticking with you. But one of them you've talked about was that you were really interested in why it was that the culture was becoming more interested in David Foster Wallace. You know, it had been, you know, it was 1996 when Infinite Jest came out, but it just sort of kept, more and more people kept getting interested in that. And in him, I suppose. What do you think, do you think you understand that now?
I think I understand just a piece of it. You know, after his death, I mean, David was not an unknown writer in 2008 when he took his own life.
Right.
But, you know, in some extent, I think that on a purely literary level, most people of the sort who were at his publication party would have said that that his best work was behind him. But for a younger generation, I don't think that was true at all. In fact, Infinite Jest was a book that was being rediscovered by each generation as it got old enough to read it. I mean, we're only talking about 10 years, but still, you know, it was being rediscovered by each graduating class, more accurately, you know, was now ready to read it. And when I went to the memorial services after David's death, you know, while I was writing the New Yorker piece, I remember being stunned at the kind of intimacy of people's reactions to his death. And then I would go online, and you know, it was just unlike anything that I've ever seen for any writer. I mean, it just wasn't it isn't the response a writer gets in you know, in the 21st century. Mm. For instance, you know, there were these comparisons to John Lennon and Kurt Cobain. Okay, those are reasonable enough. But people said that they felt that the world was an emptier or less safe place without David. I thought that was really, really interesting. And another writer at the Millions website talked about David as being a kind of almost a sort of souped up version of all of us, being, I think the words are polymathic, ironic, and under intense pressure to perform. That's right. The part that really stuck with me, that phrase, under intense pressure to perform. And so I was beginning to kind of sketch out, at least in my own mind, a connection between, you know, in some ways a fairly ordinary individual. I mean, a guy who published 4 or 5, 6 books during his life, who suffered severe depression and took his own life when he went off his medication, which is what happened in David's case, and a figure who was sort of being known kind of slightly ironically, but not entirely ironically, as Saint Dave.
Yeah. You know, you hear the piece referred to as a biography, and I guess it is a biography, but it's not a conventional biography. I mean, it was something that you've talked about. I sort of mentioned this in the introduction, that you were more interested in telling a story than a conventional biography. I mean, it is 300 pages, the book, but and you say it's longer than you had hoped it would be. So I'm wondering how you were thinking about what it is you wanted to create and what you finally did come up with in this book.
You know, it's a great question, and it has a lot of different answers. You know, the simplest answer is I wrote the book that I knew how to write and that I felt was the right book to write. But when I step back a bit and ask myself, you know, why didn't I write 600 pages? Why is there no introduction?
Yeah.
Most biographies bear a kind of introduction that, you know, effectively sort of sells you on the life. And I felt very strongly, with David's intense antipathy to selling, that I was going to hand you his story. Mm. And I almost feel as if if it succeeds, I feel the condition it's approaching is almost a memoir, you know, written not by the person who lived it.
Yeah.
You know, the book is meant to feel very immediate, and the stories in it are meant to be what powers it. I'll give you an example. The first sentence, most people begin a biography, and they begin with, you know, the Wallaces, you know, moved to, you know, upstate New York in the 1840s. You know, they were a farming family, you know, and then...
Right.
You know, slowly they made their way. The first Wallace to go to university was, you know, Ezekiel Wallace, you know, who graduated from Union College and that kind of thing. Well, I don't do that at all. Not that I don't think it can be useful in the case of some biographies. I'd certainly like to have that, say, with Emily Dickinson. But, I mean, David was alive, you know, when I started the book, David was alive 2 years ago. Now it's been all of, you know, 4 years. So how does a writer, you know, adjust to the circumstances of a death and of the changing forces, you know, in our culture, which, for instance, one thing that's amazing about Every Love Story is a Ghost Story is I don't think people were regularly writing biographies so soon after the deaths of writers 100 years ago. You know, there was a period where the writer was sort of left to dry out, and then they see what they had. Well, that's not the world that we live in for a million different reasons. You know, in a world of reality television, also financial pressures on publishers, and I think more significantly for me, a world where so much can be known so quickly, those forces aren't really the principal forces anymore. So in writing Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, I said to myself, how am I going to make this as immediate as it really is? And one way, for instance, the first sentence of the book is, every story has a beginning, and this is David Wallace's. Yeah. And then the last sentence of the book after David's very, very sad ending, you know, which, I mean, what is there you can really say about something as sad as a suicide of that sort? But the last, you know, the last sentence is something like, this was not an ending anyone would have wanted for him, but it was the one he had chosen.
Right.
So throughout the book, you know, even in the way it's constructed, there's a big emphasis on story, much like the way memoir does it. Really, memoir is a lot of ways the model for the book. You know, the thing about biography that I find tricky, and this is to simplify vastly, because there's a lot of very straightforward biographies that give great pleasure and do complete justice to their subjects. But it seemed to me that the classic form didn't really fit the life. And in fact, would sort of interfere with the kind of reader I wanted to bring in, who really felt like David was still there.
Mm. So it's almost like you, it's not like you're writing in his style, but you wanted this book to make sense with the way David himself wrote, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the opposite of his style in a lot of ways. David had this style where he included everything. You know, that's the whole point of Infinite Jest. You know, there's his response to the sort of muchness of the world, as I call it, was, you know, to include it. The epigraph of every love story is a quote from Good Old Neon, the short story David wrote in 2001, and that quote goes, "What goes on inside is just too fast and huge, and all interconnected for words to do more than barely sketch the outlines of at most one tiny little part of it at any given instant." So that's a perfect David Foster Wallace sentence, in that you keep thinking it's going to stop. And then another little clause is inserted, and it's all done with this extraordinary balance. But the idea that there's just too much in the world to record is a feeling he and I share. And he and I took two opposite tacks. I mean, David, you know, writing is illusion. So David, the illusion of David's writing is everything is in it, right? Mm. That, you know, you go, his wonderful writing about going on a cruise ship, you feel as if he's captured the fractured, extraordinary multiplicity of, you know, of human interactions in the modern era. And my approach was very much to sort of whittle away everything so that only the sort of most intense and pure impressions would be retained. But we're both dealing with the same issue, which is like, how do you capture, you know, the muchness of American society today? You know, with one thing that's unusual about David, one of the virtues or blessings of writing the first biography of a writer of his generation is that there are things that everyone will know that I'm giving to you as news, in a sense, within the biography, like the music David listened to, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's the B-52s, which actually he didn't like, or
Pink
Nick
Floyd.
Drake. You know, all that's news to a biography reader. You don't find that in most biographies of writers because it's too soon.
It's interesting that there are moments where you read about stories that he's told. There's one really early on where he talks about his father reading Moby Dick to him, and then you learn, you know, his sister saying that didn't really happen. Or you know, even in letters that he writes, stories that he tells, things that he relates, that you begin to wonder if any of this is true or how much of this is true. And that must have been an incredible obstacle to trying to figure out how to sort of figure out what actually happened in his life.
It was incredibly difficult. I mean, David, you know, David was a fiction writer. He was a fabulist. And besides being a fabulist, you know, David Foster Wallace was, you know, kind of a liar.
Right.
He wanted things to be the way they weren't often. He was full of self-doubt, and self-doubt, I think, often leads to hiding yourself. So David Foster Wallace hides himself a lot from others. You know, there's a wonderful scene in Infinite, a wonderful phrase in Infinite Jest where David's writing about a character named Helen Condenza, who, you know, has a lot in common with David and is a pothead. And he says that he suggests that Hal is as attached to the secrecy of getting high as he is to getting high. Mm. And I think, like, for David, the secrecy itself was a kind of a thrill. You know, how do you get past that? Well, you know, I think, first of all, you look at everything carefully. So when David says that he was, when David tells a friend that he, he writes a letter to an editor and friend named Steve Moore, where he says that he got into a fist fight over the book Wittgenstein's Mistress by David Markson.
Yeah.
It's a book David was writing about for Steve Moore at his magazine, The Review of Contemporary Fiction. And in this wonderfully detailed letter, David says that his nose was broken by his downstairs neighbor, you know, in this fight over Wittgenstein's Mistress. Well, I mean, two things about David Foster Wallace I had learned at this point, you know, when I read this letter. One was that he really didn't have much of a taste for violence. You know, I mean, he was sort of a fairly timid guy. And the other thing that I'd learned is that, you know, in this letter, he says actually that his nose had earlier been fractured during a game of a game of basketball with a bunch of tough kids from, the side of Boston that I know David would never have gone to without flaking in his in his shoes. You know, I think he, I don't know if he calls them homies, but basically that's the idea. And, you know, both of those things, okay, so his nose broken twice. Well, the first time almost certainly made up that he gets it broken in a basketball game. And then so, you know, the second time doesn't look so likely to me anymore, although the story is a good one. So I asked his roommate of the time, Mark Costello, and Mark, you know, Mark is a guy who lived with David for much, you know, they were college roommates, and then again they're roommates. This is taking place when they're in their late 20s. And anyway, and Mark said, I never saw anything. So, you know, is it absolutely certain his nose was never broken by his downstairs neighbor? Well, I certainly think it's pretty certain at this point, especially because, you know, David was an exaggerator, and I'm sure words were exchanged with his downstairs neighbor over Wittgenstein's Mistress, with David saying it was the most important book of the, one of the best books of the decade, is what he would write. And the downstairs neighbor was, he was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time, is one of these sort of, you know, university town types who is both a sort of mover, like as in a furniture mover, and also, you know, a PhD or a failed PhD in hermeneutics, you know, that kind of combination that you see in a university situation. So I'm sure there was a fight, but I don't think any bones were broken. I mean, now that said, I would absolutely bet you that David got a couple by me.
Yeah,
You can't go at somebody's life with an attitude of hostile, radical skepticism. I mean, it just doesn't work for your writing and your creating of the life. And, you know, there's times I may have been a bit more credulous, and there may even be times when I disbelieved him and it was true. You know, but that's what happens when you start making things up, right? People then are thrown on their own merits. And so, in writing every love story as a ghost story, I was always aware that I was dealing with a radically unreliable figure.
He grows up in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and this place where you talk about how learning is valued, but also, you know, the virtues of kindness, and in some ways the childhood was ordinary. Ordinary is how you describe it. He was an ordinary writer early on, or seemed to be anyway. But it's interesting. I wanted to ask about his mother. I mean, she was smart, she was funny, and she had this really abiding passion for words and grammar as well. And we should say that, you know, she would invent a word if there wasn't a word for something she wanted to say. And some of these words ended up in David's work. What influence does that have over him? Because it seems like in some ways, you know, there's this real devotion to the rules of words, but there's also this willingness to be playful. And that seems to be something that characterized some of David's writing.
Oh, I think that's true. You know, I mean, Sally Wallace, his mother, wrote a grammar book called Practically Painless English.
Yeah.
And it's a humorous grammar book, if such a thing can be imagined. I mean, it shows you how funny English is when it's done wrong. And you can see that humor and a kind of hothouse verbal joyousness was all over David Foster Wallace's childhood. And, you know, and it very much informs, you know, very much informs the thrill that he gets from words. And I think when David, as young men often do, becomes disappointed in himself in his 30s, I mean, David, to some extent, is always disappointed in himself, but when he becomes really disappointed in himself, you know, he turns his gaze on his mother in a fairly aggressive way. And, you know, one of the results is the figure of Averill in Cadenza.
Mm-hmm.
In Infinite Jest. So one can imagine, you know, Sally Wallace scratching her head and thinking, you know, I gave him these tools, you know, and look at how he's used them. But words for David, you know, they're in some way realer than people. I think David's great struggle, which he successfully surmounts in Infinite Jest. I mean, the reason David Foster Wallace thinks that the Room of the System could be written by a smart 14-year-old is because he doesn't think that it's more than a pile of words. And in fact, what's wonderful about the book is its whole premise is that we are all made up of nothing but words. You know, it's an idea from Wittgenstein. You know, later David is able to get beyond that, partially because of the difficulties of his own life. There are suicide attempts. Mm-hmm. He goes into a detox program. He winds up in a halfway house that's fictionalized in Infinite Jest. You know, he has such hard knocks in his life that he begins to look beyond words. I mean, words sort of fail him. And in that sense, I think at the same time, you know, one of the things I found in working on the book were these marginal notes that David left in some books in his 30s where he's very critical of his mother, talks of her as being a narcissist and not ever fully appreciating him as a person, but using him as a kind of tool for her own, you know, stunted or circumscribed ambitions, you know. But that's all part of, I think, falling out of love with words in and of themselves.
D.T. Max is with us. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. His new book is a biography of the writer David Foster Wallace. It's called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, A Life of David Foster Wallace. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer David Foster Wallace is thought of by some as the most important novelist of his generation. His book, Infinite Jest, made him something of a literary rock star. His writing probed the nature of what it means to be human. Plagued most of his life by anxiety and depression, Wallace committed suicide in 2008. Today in the program, the writer D.T. Max is with us to talk about the book he's written about Wallace, a soul who was restless, who dealt with mental illness and addiction, even as he was creating an incredibly important work of art. The book is called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, A Life of David Foster Wallace, and D.T. Max is joining us from New York. D.T. Max, I wanted to – you write about the summer of either 1971 or 72 being this really critical time. It was the first time he begins to realize that he had some kind of mental illness. He's having these panic attacks. Things are getting worse. And you write about how these experiences really gave him this kind of lifelong fear about the consequences of, as you put it, mental and emotional isolation. Talk about that time in his life.
You know, he's quite young. In 1971, 72, he's only 9 or 10 years old. And his first anxiety attacks, and these are, I mean, this is self-reported by David. There was some material that I was given from his kind of mental health letters, and he had kind of written this explanation at the end of his life of the things that really of his long history of psychiatric problems, which I make use of it carefully in the biography because, you know, it is his own account. But I think that early on he becomes fearful of things like bugs in a way that's not ordinary in a child. And then that's he's 10 or 11, and I think he considers himself sort of abnormally sensitive. But then by the time he's a young teenager, you know, the condition has progressed, and he's really having full-fledged anxiety attacks. By the time he's a junior in high school, it's hard for him to, you know, to go to school every day. And he has panic attacks where he begins to sweat uncontrollably. Yeah. And then when he sees people seeing how much he's sweating, you know, that makes him sweat more. I mean, classic sort of forward feedback loop psychiatric issues. I think one of the sort of residues for David was that, you know, there's a certain kind of person who's as intelligent as David Foster Wallace was and as academic who really spends his life kind of comfortably in his own head. You know, whether that person becomes kind of an internet junkie or they write complicated works of philosophy, you know, on the Neoplatonists, whatever. I mean, that person exists, man or woman, exists kind of separate from the world and in some way kind of comfortable. But for David, that comfort is denied because for him, the harder you think about something, the more you run the risk that your mind is just going to kind of spin round and round until you're consumed by anxiety or doubt. And the things that once seemed self-evident to you, his example is, you know, the color green really is green. Suddenly everything is thrown open and in dispute. And as a result, David can never, you know, he's never able to spend his life as he might have been destined to if he hadn't had mental illness. He has to go out and find something to steady him.
Yeah.
And what he first finds, I think, is marijuana. I mean, I think when he's in high school, it's not an accident. He discovers pot at the same time as he discovers anxiety, and he basically self-medicates. It's only later in his life that he finds, you know, basically that community. That community can save him, or can at least be the thing that you can try to save yourself with other people.
The thing that is so There's this kind of profound question that comes up, and that is, what is it, when he decides to become a writer, what are the costs to his life? Because you write about how this, you know, really his deciding to write came out of a breakdown. So he always kind of tied writing to his mental health. That ended up being the reason he killed himself. So what do you think about the costs for David Foster Wallace of deciding that he had to write or decided to be a writer?
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting question. I actually think that becoming a writer saves David Foster Wallace's life when he's in college, and that had he been a philosophy, well, David in college is headed to be an analytic philosopher. It was a very sort of dry kind of philosophy involving, you know, logic and the kind of grammatical implications of words, that kind of thing, not questions about, you know, why are we on this planet kind of thing. And so David, partway through, has a breakdown, as you mentioned, two breakdowns actually in college, despite having straight A plus average. And David then begins to write.
Yeah.
So his writing comes directly out of an attempt to deal with what he's experienced. What he's experienced is humiliating. I mean, for David Foster Wallace, it was humiliating, you know, as it would be for any undergraduate, but even more so for someone on whom such high hopes had been placed. I mean, you know, David would always write about how his mother wanted him to be this star, but of course David wanted himself to be a star. Whether it was his mother who initiated the ambition, you know, is open to questioning, even on David's part. But anyway, David has these enormous hopes. He crashes, right, with these two breakdowns in college, and he comes up a writer. So I have to believe that writing was what saved his life for such a long period. But what you say is also true, that, you know, writing is a very isolated life. It's a very introspective life. And, you know, if David could conceivably have grown up to be, you know, a dentist the way his grandfather was, you know, maybe that would have been a better outcome. But, I mean, one thing that I hope every love story or ghost story teaches you or suggests to the reader is that there are limits to how flexible personality can be. You know, David worked so hard in the later part of his life to change how he writes. He's written Infinite Jest, and he's just so sick of the praise he's getting for this maximalist novel with these endless endnotes. He's inspired a whole generation to imitate him, and he's sick of it. You know, it's enough. And so he's trying to write a different kind of novel when he writes The Pale King. I mean, in the end, he can't write it to his satisfaction. He can't really quiet who he is. So in that sense, I feel like David really didn't have that many, you know, there weren't that many things David Foster Wallace could have done with his life, despite maybe fantasizing that there were. And in fact, you know, we even have sort of unusual evidence of this, because midway through his life, David goes back to graduate school.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, midway being 29
right.
or 28, he goes back to graduate school to try and become a professor of philosophy the way his father was. And he lasts, you know, a whopping 3 weeks.
Right. You know, you write about during the years when he was in Amherst, in the summer was this time when he began to think about writing and fiction, you say, differently. He'd always liked, and always had read novels, and people were recommending these big, you know, things like, you know, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, you know. But that kind of stuff just wasn't the kind of book that he was ultimately interested in. And you say the first book that really excited him was Donald Barthelme's The Balloon. It was, he says it was the first time he heard the click right. in literature.
Yeah, what happened with David is, you know, look, he's a bright kid in the 70s, and he devoured, you know, all the books on his parents' shelves, you know, including the dirty ones. Like, you know, he there was a document that he wrote that I use in every love story, the ghost story, where he talks about reading Fanny Hill, and I think, what is the other one? Is it the story about, anyway, that satisfies one part of David. And then the other part is satisfied by, you know, all the John Updike they have on the shelf and so on. But, you know, David, I think David never realizes he can be a writer. You know, you can be a very smart boy or girl and can consume fiction and never quite understand how to make fiction, you know, or how to make writing. You know, it lives behind the sort of scrim of being printed. I think to some extent nowadays, you know, with the web and everybody being able to publish, that wall is somewhat diminished. But in David's childhood, you know, you were either published or you weren't. And so David, you know, okay, so David loves John Updike, but he doesn't really feel Updikean. You know, he doesn't feel like his purpose on this earth is to write beautiful sentences that capture every nuance of life through metaphor. You know, he's after something different. And I think, again, I firmly believe that it comes out of his anxiety and his depression, that you can't be John Updike and have that level of anxiety and depression. So David, you know, is basically has a technical mind. I mean, one of the things that always amuses me about David Foster Wallace is that I don't think in a funny way he had an ounce of poetry in him at the beginning. You know, I just think he was, you know, he was basically an internet weenie before there was an internet.
Right.
And so what he does is he looks at, you know, the stories he admires and he reverse engineers them, as I write in the book. I mean, he basically, I don't know if he literally did this or he was so bright he could just do it lying on his back in his bed. But he does it. He, you know, is able to look at a Thomas Pynchon novel or a Don DeLillo novel, or in this case, Donald Barthelme's story, The Balloon, and see, you know, what does a sentence read like? You know, where do you put the verb? Where do you, remember, he's a grammar, he's a grammarian's son. David Foster Wallace is always about structure.
Yeah.
You know, he needs structure to stay sane, but he's also learned language through structure. And so he takes Donald Barthelme's The Balloon, you know, and he sees that this is a book that leaves part of its structure revealed. So it's a little like going to one of those restaurants where, you know, the sort of the vents overhead are left exposed, you know, the tubes that you know, one of these sort of half-finished quasi-industrial spaces where they serve great brunches. So that's what Barthelme's story is to him. You know, Donald Barthelme tells a story about a balloon that floats overhead in a town and how different people in the town react differently to the balloon. Some want to kick it, some want to pop it, little kids jump up and down on it. But you don't have to be a genius to see the metaphor in that story. Yeah. You know, it's about story. Like, you know, some people find it useless, some people find it pretty and praise its contours. Well, that's critics, right? So David, you know, pulls out all the struts. I mean, he looks at this and from this he then begins to write his own fiction. That's what's so amazing about David, is it takes him no time. I mean, you know, For every love story, I went and read some of David's high school stories. They're not special. I mean, I think that they're just not special. Mm. And yet, in 4 years, partially because of these breakdowns, but partially also because David just turns that huge brain on the subject, you know, he writes The Broom of the System, a book that few adults could ever write. And I mean, very, very few. I mean, and among the strange things about The Broom of the System, it's a very beautiful book. So even though it's written by, you know, the sort of internet weenie, there's great grace in it, you know, there's great poetry in it, because he's also studied John Updike's sentences, and he's also pulled out of them how you write a beautiful sentence.
Well, it's interesting, too, because you've talked about how there's this kind of paradox in the fact that Infinite Jest in the internet era has become kind of easier to read for people who, you know, were raised during the internet era, because you talk about how these cognitive jumps in that book today for people who, you know, have that kind of sensibility, they feel less extreme, you say, after a generation of internet surfing, is how you put it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think, you know, I mean, David Foster Wallace goes down much easier today than he did in 1996. And now, to some extent, that's just familiarization. I mean, you know, nobody can look at Van Gogh's work with the same shock, you know, that it elicited when it was first seen. You know, James Joyce's Ulysses was easier for me to read than it could have been for my father, because your expectations and your sense of what is music, you know, changes, right? But there are limitations on that. I mean, I don't think Honegger sounds easy to anyone even today. And I think, you know, by the same token, Finnegan's Wake isn't easy to read even today. But David had the peculiar gift or accident of kind of I mean, David believed that life was fragmented in the modern era. And so fiction, you know, this sounds easy, like you could do it at home, but it's not. So fiction has to be fragmented too. Of course, for David, the great question is, well, he knows that, you know, David Foster Wallace is so smart. He knows that fiction isn't, you know, imitation. Yeah. It's art. So how do you artfully fragment something? How do you make something seem modern or up to the minute without it actually just being a transcription? And paradoxically, that style, which involves a lot of kind of high-low, you know, fancy words followed by very plain words, half sentences, a lot of use of conjunctions. I mean, I'm not making it sound very interesting, but it is really delightful to read it in Infinite Jest. That becomes kind of the way people write blogs, you know. I mean, partially just because David's fiction was in some ways less formal than anyone else's. You know, if you compare David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest with, say, John Franzen's The Corrections, you know, they're friends.
Right.
And The Corrections comes out 5 years after Infinite Jest. Like, The Corrections seems a much more conservative novel, verbally, like linguistically. It's just, it does not break rules. I mean, it does have some aspects of the plot that are new, but the form and the sentences, they're not. But you look at Infinite Jest and you find these, you know, you just find that it violates all the rules. And yet, you know, you give it to a 20-year-old, and it's really the 20-year-olds who are carrying David forward on their shoulders. Mm-hmm. And they don't find it so hard to read. I mean, the hardest thing to do with Infinite Jest is sit down and read it straight through. But what if that isn't really your expectation anymore? And I don't think with David Foster Wallace that the people who read him have that expectation. They may devour him and they read him quickly, but I don't think they sit down and read him straight through because they have their... You know, they have their iPhones, you know, and they have their video games, and they have their, you know, their instant messaging. And I just think their expectations of what's quiet have changed. And ours are different. I mean, ours are quite different, don't you think, Doug? For instance, like, you and I sit down to read. We don't have the same expectations someone had 100 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, their phones didn't ring. You know, maybe somebody came to the door with a message.
Well, it's interesting because I'm trying to figure. I mean, he was around during the internet era, of course.
Yeah.
But he, you know, you mentioned, for example, he wrote this thing to his friend where he only, as he put it, webulized once a week. Like he really only, because he really did, I guess, figure that we are being entertained to death. And you've talked about the fact that really for the internet for him, he wasn't about information. He was about kind of being a voyeur, looking at stories. So he would have taken in the internet different than any of us would have, at least now, most of us in any way, I suppose.
You know, there's a wonderful phrase at the beginning of an essay he wrote on television where he says, you know, fiction writers are born oglers or oglers. I never know how to say that word. And, you know, that's true of David. Like, if he could watch you and not be seen, that was really his favorite stance. People don't really, I think, understand that about him. They think that he was an addict, you know, of television because it was always on. Yeah, sort of. That's true, too, right? I mean, it was easy and it was available, and you turned it on in your living room or in your bedroom. You just watched and watched. And David, you know, David had a number of addictions, marijuana, clearly. I think that it's pretty clear from my research that he had a sex addiction. He certainly spoke of it that way.
Yeah.
But he always said his primary addiction was to television.
Yeah.
So you think, yeah, okay, this is a guy who, like, I mean, he lives until 2008. It's not as if the web, you know, wasn't pretty much what it is today in 2008. But it never grabs him the way television grabbed him. And it's always, you know, I struggled a lot to understand this for the biography because I'm actually the opposite. I mean, I'm not really that interested in watching reruns of Happy Days the way he was, you know. I'm much more interested in the fact that you can find out, you know, you can look at a translation of... the Rosetta Stone online and see the three languages and give yourself a kind of quick, you know, study in demotic, you know, in demotic Egyptian.
Yeah.
That wasn't him. I mean, he was a scholar, a greater scholar than I'll ever be, but that wasn't how he used these technologies. You know, he had an Oxford English dictionary in paper form and he loved to jump up and consult it. But I don't think that he was, you know, addicted to it in the same way that he was addicted to television. And you point out exactly the difference, which is what's so fascinating. One reason that I think he's really had to be a writer, as we spoke of earlier, is he was addicted to people in action. He was addicted to people in motion. He was addicted to people in communication. In other words, he was addicted to story.
Yeah.
And, you know, what more natural fate for a person addicted to story than to himself, you know, write stories. And so... just, you know, thinking a little bit about the title of the biography, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, you know, there's multiple meanings to that, but one of the meanings is about his addiction to story. You know, he can't stop being a writer, and it becomes a ghost story.
D.T. Maxx, his book, again, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, A Life of David Foster Wallace, joined us today from the offices of The New Yorker in Midtown Manhattan. D.T. Maxx, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks for having me on.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. The show produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.